We talked last week, just to do a quick review, we talked last week about the introductory verses of Kohelet from Pasuk Aleph through Pasuk Yud Aleph from 1 to 11. One of the things that we saw was that this whole section kind of poses itself as a introduction to the themes of the book. And the reason for that is twofold. Number one, it talks about Kohelet in third person, Divrei Kohelet ben David. This is essentially a summary of the framework of the book of Kohelet. And then in verse 12, besides the paragraph break, it says, Ani Kohelet, in first person, I Kohelet was king over Israel. So there's certainly a transition between the introduction, first 11 verses, and the continuation of the text. We'll see a very similar kind of transition at the very end of the book. If I jump to chapter 12, the end of the book also has right in the middle, by verse 7, kind of have his conclusion, and then verse 8 begins with the same statement with which the book began. Hevel havelim mar kohelet hakol havel. Right, that statement. Hevel havelim, vanity of vanities. Kohelet said. Right, again speaking of Kohelet in third person, and exactly the same phrase as with which the book began. Divrei Kohelet ben David. Hevel havelim mar kohelet hakol havel. So there are many who suggest, and we talked about this briefly. Somebody sent me an email asking me about a parish of the Rashbam. The Rashbam makes this argument. It's not clear that that commentary called the Rashbam on Kohelet is in fact the Rashbam on Kohelet. There's some discussion as to whether it's a manuscript that's unnamed and it says things similar to what the Rashbam says on Chumash. And so they assume that it's the Rashbam. It's why it's called the parish HaMiyuchas the Rashbam. So sort of associated with the Rashbam. But he certainly is one of the Rishonim, or at least the Rashbam, if not the Rashbam, then at least his grandson, or at least his student. And he makes the claim that the opening verses and the closing verses were written by a later editor. I don't have an issue with that. I think we talked about the fact that there's no question that Kohelet goes through a series of editing over the course of years. Its initial formulation is probably oral. That I think was Maidan's observation. And then either during the time of Chizkiyahu, the Gemara says, or more likely during the time of the Anshe Knesset HaGedolah, when the rest of Tanakh is kind of canonized, it goes through a kind of editing. And at that point in time, it's likely that the beginning and end are added. But like the Rashbam, I would argue that the rest of the text certainly is connected to Shlomo directly. I don't think it matters, because it certainly pulls from the themes of the book itself and reflects the content of the book. And that's what I wanted to kind of pull today, as we can further our introduction to what I call the cast of characters. So Kohelet is essentially, as we understand it, or we're trying to understand it, a conversation that Shlomo is almost having with himself. It's an internal dialogue. And that's essentially the chiddush that both Rav Yoav ben Nun and Rav Maidan put forward. And I think that that's where we're going to kind of follow that lead, that rather than looking at the book as a kind of a mix of ideas, and you never know where he's grounded and what he's saying and who he's speaking to and what's going on, rather than kind of seeing all the contradictions, as Chazal point out, we look at the book as a kind of a dialogue, and a dialogue between four of the core voices that make up the personality of Shlomo HaMelech, or the different aspects of Shlomo's life. And we're going to explore exactly how they fit into those aspects of Shlomo HaMelech himself. That's sort of on the docket for the next unit. If we get to it today, great. If not, we'll certainly look at it, Be'ezrat Hashem, next week. Where we had left off was a kind of an introduction to the main theme of the introduction of this section, as well as the personalities that are alluded to or hinted at in this description. He's describing a kind of endless cycle, this futile cycle of nature. He describes it in terms of four characteristic examples of how the world kind of goes through this endless cycle. They are Dor Lech V'Dor Ba, generation after generation. The earth endures, continues forever. Generations come and go. The sun rises and sets, and then returns to where it came from. The wind goes around and round. Again, we have this parallel between east, west, and north, south. And the water also goes from one place to another, from the rivers into the sea and from the sea into the rivers. So all of these four describe a kind of a metaphor of, or a symbol of the kind of endless cycles of nature. We then raise the question of how do you take a cycle of nature and use it as a conclusion of or derive from it conclusions regarding the human condition? And clearly that's what he does, because from those four cycles of nature, he immediately jumps to the state of the human being. Kol advarim yega'im, man is full of weary, lo yichal ish. The man cannot speak, he cannot see, he cannot hear. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, the ear is not filled with listening. What was will be, what will be again. A person will say, oh, look, this is new. No, it's not new. It was. People are not remembered in Zichron LaRishonim. The first deeds aren't remembered by the later deeds. Later deeds are forgotten in the generations that come after them. So all of these last four verses from Pasuk Chet through Yud Aleph are really about the human condition. And that's a big jump. So what we had suggested, and this is sort of the jumping part, jumping pad for the rest of the book, is that these cycles that he's describing here are metaphors for the very four personalities that we are going to encounter in the text. And again, whether they're written by Shlomo or they're written several generations later, doesn't bother me. What we're gonna see is that the four personalities of the text are clearly part of Shlomo's frame of reference, and we had introduced them and we articulated them and who they are, and so we charted this out. Dor Lech V'Dor Ba Ve'Aretz Lo Hamadet. There is this cycle of generations coming and going. We'll talk about the human element in that in a moment. But the land, the earth, endures forever. Zerach Hashemesh, the fire, the sun, which rises and sets. The sun representing wisdom. We'll see that in a second. Sun representing light and fire. The wind, Alech Al Darom, the spirit, and Konan Nechalim Olchim El Hayam, all of the rivers, this cycle of water. That kind of, where metaphor fits into the world of Tanakh, we also talked about briefly. I'm not going to review that again. That's on the recording. You're welcome to look at it, to listen to it. There's a number of places where you have this idea of metaphor as a component of biblical interpretation. You have it in Shoftim with the Yotam, who stands up on the hilltop and gives them a parable about kings represented by trees and different kinds of trees. You have it in Yechezkel. We looked at various examples. What I'm much more interested in is understanding the symbolism of these four cycles. What do they represent in the context of the book itself? And again, whether or not this introduction was written later, and to Rabashi, your point, maybe even after the articulation of the four states of basic elements of are part of the conversation in intellectual wisdom, it's only a couple of hundred years after Shlomo. But from our perspective, what I'm looking for is in the text of the book itself. What do these cycles represent and how are they articulated? And so for that, we're going to start a journey into Kohelet. Now, we're not going to yet do it in sequence. We're going to get to that at the end. Right now, I just want to pull phrases out of the book and see if they help me understand the meaning of these four cycles. Okay, so just to articulate, right? These four cycles are part of the introduction. They describe the earth, the sun, the wind, and the water. What I'm looking for is either in language or in symbolism, what do they represent? And that will help me identify the personalities of the book. So I'm going to jump to the bottom of this screen, which is the part that I don't think was on the source page last week. And we're going to look at a couple of phrases. Now, these are all pulled out of Kohelet. So again, if anybody doesn't have the source page and wants it, I'll just post it again. These are all pulled out of the text of Kohelet itself. So it's helpful from our perspective. I'm going to jump back to my main text, which sort of website, which I use for the text. But for now, I just pulled them and pasted them here. So let's look at the first one. The first one is the cycle of water. And in Kohelet Perek Aleph, the cycle of water is described as Kol ha-nechalim olchim al hayam ve-hayam enenu male. All the rivers run into the sea, and the sea is never full. That's the language. In Perek Vav, which is part of the core of the book, we find the following articulation, following verse. Perek Vav, Pasuk Zayin, chapter 6, verse 7. Kol amal ha-adam lefiu, ve-gam ha-nefesh notimale. All of man's labor is for his mouth, to feed his mouth, to feed his hunger, and yet the appetite is never filled. And what he's articulating there is one of our four personalities. We'll figure out who it is in when we get to that part of the text, but we'll kind of have a hint to it here. But the description of the notion that a person works and toils and all of the effort of his gain is for one purpose. And that one purpose is to satiate one's appetite. Right? Why do we eat? Because we're hungry, right? But from a philosophical perspective, forgetting science and what we know about calories and energy and fuel and for the body, et cetera, but just from a perspective, a certain kind of external visual perspective, the more you eat, the more hungry you get. It's just the irony of it, right? You can eat and eat and eat, but you're never satiated. You never fill that appetite, right? Maybe temporarily, but 5 hours later, 6 hours later, you're hungry again. And so you eat again. And when you look at it from that perspective, all of the food, all of the effort of man is to feed his appetite. And yet the appetite is never satiated. And the nefesh you're referring to, the soul or the body, the physical body, meaning the person is never, the appetite is never, never satiated. Ha-nefesh lo timaleh. So from that perspective, what I found, what's interesting about this verse is that the structure of the text, the language of this text in Perek Vav, Kol Amal Adam Lefiu, Ve'Nefesh Lot Timalei, is almost identical to the structure of the cycle described in Perek Aleph. The rivers flow into the sea, and the sea is never full. And that gives us our first metaphor. Namely, that the water in this introduction refers to the notion of this kind of insatiable appetite. That the appetite is never filled, that a person enjoys and eats. One of the four personalities that we're going to see in the text is this idea of the person who wants to enjoy life. He wants to get the physical pleasures out of life. What we will term to use a much later term from philosophy, the hedonist, right? The man of passion, the man of desire, the man of hana'ah, nehaneh, which is the language Kohelet uses. The person who wants to benefit and to enjoy the world, simcha, right? In the context of enjoyment of the world. But that's a never-ending abyss, because the more you fill it, the deeper it gets, and the less it feels full. And so that's exactly the metaphor of the rivers that flow into the sea, and the sea is never full. A person can feed his appetite all day long, and the appetite is never full. Kol amal adam lefiu v'gam ha-nefesh lo timaleh. So that's our first clue, that the water cycle represents the cycle of the appetite, the hedonist, the person who wants the joy and the simcha out of life. Number one. Okay. So let's look at the second.
But I'm not sure if simcha is hedonism. They're complete in my mind.
Well, we'll see it in the context. We'll see it in the book. In the book, it is. It's used in two different ways. But in this, in the Kohelet will use simcha and Kohelet will use simcha. Sorry, there's some background noise. I'm just going to mute the background noise. Kohelet will use simcha and physical pleasure and enjoying the world, kind of feeding that appetite in the same breath, in the same language. So it may not be the way we use it, but I think it is the way in which, at least for a good part of the text, he says, "Ulesimcha mazu osa," right? What does it get you? So that kind of attitude. The second is the shemesh. And that's a much easier one to identify because that appears in many texts within both Tanakh and in general philosophy of later time periods. And that is to look at Shemesh from a perspective of light. Right? What is the primary? We identified it as fire, but I don't think that's accurate. I think its primary characteristic that is identified in the Torah is that the Shemesh and Yireach, the sun and the moon, are the luminaries of the sky. They provide light. And that's the real characteristic, not so much the fire here, but the light, that is kind of worked through in Kohelet. You have, for example, verses like, this is in chapter 2, V'ra'iti ani shi'yesh yitron la'chochma min ha'suklut, Kitron ha'or min ha'choshech. I see that wisdom excels, has an advantage over folly, meaning the opposite of wisdom, in as far as light excels over darkness. Right? The power, that parallel is clear. Light and chokhmah are reflected here, right? Or min ha'choshech and chokhmah over sichlut. And a chacham in Abirosho, the wise person has eyes in his head. The fool walks in darkness. So Rashi there makes the same. Actually, it's a Rashi in Perek Zayin. Tova chokma im nachala. The wisdom is better with inheritance, with financial substance, etc. To borrow themes from Kohelet. However, yoter, the advantage goes if he had to weigh. Chochma and Nachla, if you had to weigh wisdom versus inheritance, financial gain, which is what the book is about amongst many themes, Kohelet and Perek Zion says the advantage, Yoter, goes to those who can see the sun, the Ro'ei HaShemesh. And here it's very clear that the Ro'ei HaShemesh is a parallel to the Chacham, or the Chochma. And that's what Rashi says. Rashi says the Ro'ei HaShemesh is a reference to the Chochma. And he continues, "Ki b'tzala chokhma b'tzala kasaf yitron dat ha-chokhma t'chaye ba'ala." Wisdom is defenses, even as money is a defense, but excellency of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. It's a very awkward translation. I'm not crazy about these translations, but you get the idea that what we're dealing with in the sun is less about the fire, because I'm not even sure that they knew that the sun was essentially a ball of fire. Maybe they did or not, I don't know. But the context in which it's used in Kohelet is always in the context of light. And light is a metaphor for wisdom, just as the menorah symbolizes wisdom in the Beit HaMikdash, right? The different branches of wisdom, as the Mefarshim point out. So the notion of the cycle of wisdom, and we'll see why this is a problem for Kohelet. The sun rises, the sun sets, and then it returns again, is parallel to the generations coming and going. If the Shemesh represents wisdom or represents the mind, represents human knowledge or philosophy or knowledge, chacham, then what's the endless cycle here that we will explore? But there's certainly something to be said. He says it in Perek Bet, Kimikre aksil gamani yikreni, as it has, the fate of the fool will happen to me as well. So why did I go to all that effort to become wiser than any other person? In other words, what haunts Kohelet more than anything else, we'll see, is the fact that wisdom is temporary. because the brain is temporary, and eventually, either through the process of senility or through the process of death, at the end of the day, in the grave, the skull of the fool and the skull of the philosopher look exactly the same, right? And that image of Kimikre Ksil Gamaniakrani, that haunts Kohelet. Sorry, for one second, I'm just going to turn my video off. Right? Whoops. Okay. That haunts Kohelet. And that's our second metaphor, the notion of the Shemesh representing light as a function of Chochmah, intellect, and what that represents. The third and the fourth kind of intersect, and that's the world of the ruach, the world of the wind, which we described in the metaphor, in which will have its representation and its manifestation in the book. But more importantly for us, Kohelet uses the term ruach specifically to refer to the soul of the human being. And he does so in a number of places. Mi yodea ruach bnei adam olai lamala v'ruach ha-be'ema ha-yeredet hi lamata la'aretz. Who knows the spirit of man, whether it goes up, and the spirit of animals, whether they go down to the earth, right? Which is a reference you'll come back to at the end in chapter 12. V'yashov v'afar al ha'aretz kishehaya v'aruach tashuv el Elohim asher netana. Which is probably the last verse that Shlomo HaMelech himself articulated before the conclusion that was written later, that the earth returns to the earth as it was, the spirit returns to God who gave it. Similarly, in chapter 11, he talks about the process of birth and birthing and conception, and he says there, Kasher incha yodea maderech haruach ka'atzamim bebetan amaliya, just as you don't know the way of the wind or the spirit in how the bones grow in the womb of one who is with child, meaning that there is an element of the unknown in the process of birth, and that ruach that enters into the human being is similar to the bones of the human being. We just don't know, and we don't know how that happens, right? There's an unknown element in the context of birth. So from that perspective, if I combine the afar here, which is certainly talking about the body, the physical body of the human being, and the ruach, which is talking about the spirit of the human being, go back to creation and how creation is described. The human being is described as afar min adama, earth from the ground, and vayipach be'apav nishmat chayim. God blew into his nostrils the spirit of life. So there is an element of ruach and afar that is described here in terms of the physical and the spiritual dimensions of the human being. If we come back to our four-part metaphor, so the afar representing the physical body of the human being, the ruach representing the life force of the human being, Mayim representing the wisdom, the intellect of, sorry, the wisdom, no, that's a mistake. That is a misprint. I apologize. Shemesh representing the intellect and wisdom of the human being, and Mayim representing the passion, that should say passion or desire of the human being. Essentially, these are the four elements that we find in the, represented by this metaphor of the introduction. And as we will begin to explore, we will see that these are exactly the four personalities we will encounter in the Book of Kohelet. The person who wants to do nothing more than build and accomplish in the world. He will talk about toil, effort, amal, kol amal adam lefiyu. The term for toil in Kohelet is amal, and the identity for our purposes, we're going to need a name for these four individuals. We don't have her first name, so we're going to call them by titles. So we're going to call the first one the builder or the amal. The second one we're going to call the intellect, the person of the philosopher, to borrow a term from that comes later in history, right? The chacham, which is the term that Tanakh uses. The man of passion, ta'ava, the hana'ah, man who wants to achieve, to accomplish, to be able to enjoy the world that he has created for himself, the man who wants to consume it and to benefit from it. We have this, it's a hard one to identify by name. Again, even the hedonist and the man of passion, which are both, hedonist is again a borrowed term from a later era, but it fits the description. And in Hebrew, they refer to him as the nehenatan, the one who wants to benefit, nehene, or hana'a, from the world. And of course, the fourth, which is the man of spirit, who will eventually transform or morph. Right now, he serves part of the metaphor of the four cycles of nature, but we will see this particular manifestation in the terms of the Yirei Elokim, or the man of faith, or the man of God. And that's more or less the four personalities that we will encounter. And the imagery of the afar representing the physical man, ki afar atav yal afar tashuv, for you are destined to dust you return, which is what God says to Adam HaRishon after he expels him from Gan Eden. Right? The notion of the shemesh representing light, or wisdom, the philosopher, the ruach representing spirit, or the spiritual man of faith, and of course the mayim, the water representing passion, and the desire or the insatiable appetite the human being has. All of these four come together to represent to begin the dialogue of the Book of Kohelet. And as we begin to explore the text, we're going to look at each one of these and say, okay, who's speaking? Is the one speaking the Amal, or is the one speaking the Nehenatan? Is the one speaking the toiler, or is the one speaking the passion, the hedonist? Or is the one speaking the builder, or is the one speaking the one who fears God? Each one is going to speak differently. They're going to use different tones of speech. They're going to have different forms of speech, different attitudes, different expressions, and all conversing with each other. That's the challenge now, to unpack this map. So what I've given you here, with one typo, I apologize for that, is I've given you the map of Kohelet. The much more expansive version of this map we'll discuss at the very end of the course, which is to divide Kohelet literally up into speeches, much like Sefer Iyov, and to divide who speaks when and to whom is he speaking. That's the end goal of our analysis of the text. It's going to take us a little while to get there. So hang on, we're going to get there towards the end. All right, so let's look at an example. I'm going to come back to the text of Kohelet for a second, Kohelet Perek Aleph. We're still in the introductory section, so again, I can't lay claim that this part was written by Shlomo. It could easily have been written by either the Chizkiyahu and his Beit Din Chazal say, or by the Second Temple period, which is also very likely beginning of the Second Temple and period of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, who canonized Tanakh all the way up to the sages of Yavne. But nonetheless, if I look at just past the metaphor takes us to Pasuk Zion, right? These are the four examples we gave: Dorolech, Zerach HaShemesh, the sun, the wind, and the rivers. I get to the following description of the condition of the human being. The matter is weary. Lo yichal ish ledaber, lo tizba'ayin lirot, v'lo timale ozen mishmoa. It's weary. The condition of the human being is weary. Man cannot, there's too much to speak. This man cannot see, and he can't, and his ear cannot hear. And I may be stretching it here, but there is this. Anytime I see a three-part metaphor for a frustration in Kohelet, I have to remind myself that there are three personalities that stand in contrast to the one who fears God. There is the Amal, the builder, who wants to mashpia in the world, who wants to influence the world, he wants to change the world. He wants to articulate a vision for the world or build it in his way, right? There is the Chacham, who is symbolized by light and seeing, and wisdom that is sort of the vision of seeing the world in a nice, in a pristine way. And there is the hedonist, or the one who wants to enjoy the world, who wants to receive from the world that which the world can provide to them. Well, look at the way this is articulated. Lo yichal ish l'daber, person, there's not enough words to speak and to utter and to do. There's not enough, the eye gets tired of seeing, and the ear gets, cannot be filled. Lo timale ozen mishmo. So in a sense, the same language used earlier to describe the metaphor of the three states of nature are used here to describe the frustration of the human condition. The person, the amal, who can't speak, the chacham, who cannot see, and the nehenatan, right, the one who wants to benefit, to derive benefit, whose appetite can never be satiated, like an ears can't hear anymore. And all of these examples will continue to reverberate throughout of the text. In the meantime, right now, the conclusion isn't good. Right now, the conclusion is not good. In each one of our fronts, we are frustrated. The philosopher is frustrated because, right, in the end of the day, if I go back to this to text here, right, the philosopher is frustrated because the end of the philosopher and the end of the fool is the same. Right? The nehne is never satiated because, right, the nehnatan, the one who is the man of the hedonist or the man of passion, is frustrated because he can never get enough. There's no quantity that you can provide him that will satiate that passion, that hunger. And the amal, the builder, is frustrated also because in the end, nothing remains. In the end, the world will, everything gets destroyed. He dies as well. So in this notion of, and we talked a little bit about this last week or the week before, the themes of Kohelet kind of mirror a little bit of the Gan Eden themes, where life and death kind of are the ultimate challenge to Kohelet. What is it going to mean for him in terms of the accomplishments of this world, whether in terms of amal, building, toil, creating, doing, if the end it ends up in the grave, or the chacham, if he ends up in the grave, or the man of passion, who is never satiated, never satisfied. That's where the text begins. And at this point in time, the outlook is very, somebody said last week, very pessimistic. But that's because we're only at the beginning of the book, right? It's hard to, right? When they say don't judge a book by its cover, I don't think it's by its cover that we can't judge Kohelet. I think it's by its opening chapter, or second chapter, or third chapter, or fourth chapter, for that matter. Meaning, it's a long journey until he reaches his conclusion. But he will reach a conclusion that is very clear. So, what I thought, especially because somebody, I'm kind of haunted by that conversation we had last week about the questions without answers and where that leads. It might be helpful to us to see where the book ends up and how he gets there. What's the journey? So if this is chapter one, I'm going to take us on a big jump, and this is the metaphor he uses to describe the water, the wind, the earth, and the sun, right? All of the elements of the human condition that are represented by nature and the endless cycle of nature. I'm going to take us on a big jump to the end of the book. Okay? So let's jump to, and not even chapter 12, chapter 12, let's jump to chapter 11. I'll jump to a part of the book that everybody agrees is not part of the epilogue, right? Part of the text itself. And I want to take a look at the opening 8-9 verses. And you'll see right away why this introduction is so powerful in terms of presenting the story in terms of these four cycles. Here it begins, chapter 11. Now, I will already tell you our conclusion, which is that our conclusion is that chapter 11 is the final speech of the Yirei Elokim. Okay, so now we know, you know how the book ends. The final word is given to the one who fears God. I'm hoping that's not a surprise to anybody. Okay, because at the end of the book, end of the day, the book is in Tanakh. If the Yirei Elokim didn't have the final word, it wouldn't be in Tanakh. And he says the following. Shlach lach mechal pnei amayim. Cast your bread out upon the water. Ki berov hayamim timsenu. After many days, it'll come back to you. Ten chelek l'shiva v'gam l'shmona. Give a portion to 7 and even to 8. That verse is confused. Every one of the commentaries, unclear what it's talking about. Ki lo teda mayira ala aretz. You never know what evil will be upon the earth. Meaning, this is most likely a reference to take a portion, put it away for what we call a rainy day. Okay, just put it aside, hold on to it. You never know, you may need it one day, and then it'll help you when there is a calamity upon the world. Coming back to Pasuk Gimel, im yimleu he'avim geshem al haaretz yariku, if clouds fill with rain, they empty that water upon the earth. V'im yipol etz badarom v'im betzafon, and if a tree falls in the south or in the north, mekom sheyipol etz sham yehu, where the tree fell, there it shall be. Meaning, if the tree falls and rains fall on top of the tree, what happens? Right? New trees will form from the seeds that come from the tree that has fallen. Shomer ruach lo yizra. One who watches the wind will never seed or sow his ground. Ve'ro'e be'avim lo yiktzor. One who watches the clouds will never reap. Ka'asher incha yodea madelech ruach. Just as you don't know the way of the wind, katsamim bebetan amalia, or how the bones grow in the womb of one who is a child, kacha lo teda maaseh Elokim. So too, you don't know how God works, asher aseh hakol, for he does everything. Therefore, babok ezrat zerecha, in the morning, sow your seed, ule'erev al tanach yadecha, and don't withhold your seed in the evening either. Because you never know which one of the two is going to be successful. Zeozeh, the one you plant in the morning or the one you plant in the evening. Ve'im shneem ki echad tovim, or maybe they'll both be successful. Umatoka or, light is sweet. Remember, light is a metaphor, right? Light is sweet. V'tov le'inayim lirot et ha'shemesh. Further proof to what I said earlier, that in Kohelet, the sun is a representation of light, not fire, right? Light is sweet, and it is pleasant to see the sun, meaning to see the light of wisdom. Kim shenim harbe yichya adam, if a person lives many years, b'kulam yismach, let him enjoy those years. B'yizkor et yemei ha'choshech, and remember the days of darkness. Ki harbe yu, there shall be many. Kol shebahava. Smach b'chur b'yaldotecha, rejoice in your youth. Itivcha libcha b'mei b'churatecha, and let your heart cheer in the days of your youthfulness. V'alech b'davchei libecha, follow your heart, b'marei necha and your eyes. V'da, but know this, y'al kol ele iviecha ha'elokim la'mishpat. God will bring you to judgment and accountability for all of these things. Okay, for now we can stop here. I want to come back to the beginning of the story and look at this from the perspective of the reference to the same cycles with which the text began, or at least the introduction began. In other words, what I'm suggesting to you is that the introduction is pulled from its conclusion. Even if Shlomo didn't write the introduction, he certainly wrote its conclusion, and from that we created the introduction. And if I look at it from the perspective of each cycle, what is he saying? Let's look at it from the perspective of water for a moment. Shlach lach mechap ne'amayim, cast your bread upon the waters. Put some away for the future. Im yimlu ha'avim geshem al aretz yariku. If the world clouds fill with rain, they will empty themselves upon the earth. And if a tree falls in the north or in the south, there it shall be. Makom shi'ipol ha'etz sham yehu. Look at this from the perspective of the cycle of water or the cycle of wind and how they interact with each other, because they do interact with each other. And what's he saying? At the beginning of the book, he looked at the cycle of water as a symbol of this insatiable appetite. But just to look at the metaphor for a second, you have the water of the rivers, sweet waters in the rivers, flowing into the salty water of the sea and getting lost. Oh, what a shame, right? Waters in the Nachal, water in the rivers, which are so beautiful and so sweet, etc., and they flow into the ocean and get lost. And then they eventually flow back into the river. But what do I accomplish by that? Well, wait a second. How did the water go from the sea to the river? There's a cycle. And in that cycle, I have rain. If the clouds fill with water and then they empty their clouds upon the earth, the clouds fill with water, they empty on the ground. And that water then ends up back into my nachal. But that's not just futile cycle. That's fertile cycle. Pardon the pun. Because I need that water. I need that water to seed the earth. I need that water to fuel the seed that I plant in the earth. And so suddenly the wind, which interacts with the water in order to bring the seeds from the fallen tree to different places and for the forests to grow and for life to be able to exist, I need that cycle. Now, back in Perek Aleph, I had no idea. All I looked at was what I could see with my eyes. And what I could see with my eyes was water here, water there, and an endless cycle. But suddenly Kohelet says, wait a second. There's a part of the cycle that we don't see. We don't see how the water goes from the sea back into the Nachal. And in so doing, rains upon the earth and the wind carries the seed from place to place. North, south, east, west. We don't see how the cycle of wind and the cycle of water combine together to bring life to this world. Right? Because we think we know everything, but we really don't. And so from that introduction, he then moves into the next part, which is the afar and the ruach, the body, the human spirit, the human being and body and spirit. Kasher encha yodei. Oh, sorry, I'll skip verse 4. This is another powerful one. Shomer ruach lo yizra, v'ro'e be'avim lo yiktzor. Meaning, if I take the perspective of I only operate with that which I know. Right? That's what Kohelet's saying. I look at the world. I see this cycle. I don't understand it. It's all futile. If you operate with only that which you know, well, you will never plant and you will never reap and you will never harvest. Because everybody all knows that the weatherman is only right 50% of the time. And that's in modern science. Can you imagine in ancient times? If you're looking for the wind, Shomer Ruach, if you're guarding, waiting for the right season, and here, Rav Asher, I'll agree with you that I think we're getting close to the season, a metaphor as well. But if you're looking for the wind in the right place, and the right element, and the right strength, and the right moment, you're never going to plant. And if you're looking for the clouds to bring rain, you're never going to reap, because there are things you just don't know. Right? Anything past a 4-day forecast is irrelevant. And that's in modern times. That which we don't know is so much more than that which we do know. That's my takeaway. Kasher in chayod, and that's when he moves into verse 5. Kasher in chayod amaderach ruach. You have no way of knowing how the soul, how the spirit enters into the human being. We don't know God's ways. There's an element here that I'm skipping because we haven't gotten to it, which is the whole metaphor, the whole issue of Tzadik v'ra'al, righteous who suffer, and the wicked who prosper, etc. And he's kind of alluding to that here, but we haven't gotten to it yet, but it's addressed here as well. There are things we just don't know. Not only in terms of, right, we think we know everything, but we don't. And therefore, Babok Ezrat Zarecha, Ule'edav Al Tanach Yadecha, is an unbelievable verse. It says, plant your seed in the morning and plant your seed in the evening. In the morning seed, we're talking about the seed that you have to plant, even though you don't know if the wind is going to blow and the rain is going to come, because you have to just trust. Right? Chazal say that each of the different Mishnayot, the orders of the Mishnah, are represented by a different word, and the word that represents the order of Zraim, Seder Zraim, which is all the Mishnayos about planting and about vegetation and food, the word is Emunah. Seder Emunah is a Seder Zraim. Right? The order of the Mishnah representing growth and laws of plants is the ultimate expression of faith. That's why Brachot, all the laws of Brachot, are in the beginning of Zraim. Because we just don't know. The planting and harvesting is the greatest act of faith that we have. Because we're totally reliant upon factors that are outside of our control. Babok Ezrat Zarecha. And the other factor that's outside of our control is human beings, is giving birth to children. Don't abandon that effort either. You have no idea which will be more prosperous, the seed you plant in the ground or the seed you plant in the birth of the next generation. Dor lech v'dor ba. And if they'll both be successful. And therefore embrace wisdom, matoka or. And embrace youthfulness, and embrace joy, and embrace every aspect of life in its proper context. Therefore, smach b'chor b'yaldutecha, rejoice and embrace the world of the nehene, and plant and enjoy and embrace the world of the amal, and matoka or, and enjoy and embrace the world of the philosopher and the wisdom. But know all of this within the context of the one thing you do know. So a lot of things we don't know, but one thing we do know. God runs this world, and eventually he will hold every single human being accountable for their actions. That's a theme that we'll come to many times in this book. This is the articulation of the Yirei Elokim. Now I want to show you just how far this goes. If there was any theme relevant to this section of the text, if there was anything that came out of this text, it is that we know much less than we think we know, and what we don't know far outweighs that which we know. In every domain. And that's ultimately his message to the Rei Elokim, says to the other three, to the Amal, who wants to plant and build and create and succeed, to the Nehenah, who wants to enjoy, and to the Chacham, who wants to philosophize and understand the world, right? There's an element, there's a role to each of them, provided they're willing to accept that they don't know everything. That there's an element of the unknown and the element of the unpredictable, that ultimately there is a God who runs this world who is far bigger than any of us. That's how his conclusion is. And I'll contrast that for a second with the beginning of the book, not the part that we read, but the next part of the text. I just want to show you something over here. This is back in Perek Bet for a second. I jumped for a moment, but I just want to show you something. I should have done this before we embarked on this, but I just want to show you the perspective of Perek Bet. Higdalti ma'asai, I made myself great. Baniti li batim, I built houses. Natati li kremim, I planted vineyards. Asiti li ganot u'pardesim, I made gardens and parks. And natati I planted trees in all of them. Asiti li brachot mayim, I made pools of water. And I planted yard tzomeach etzim, I planted forest trees from which these, from this water pools of water that I made. I'm bought male servants and female servants and servants born in my house, and I had great possessions of herds and flocks, and beyond all came before me in Yerushalayim. Kanastali kesef and zahav, I gathered gold and silver from myself. I was the treasurer of kings and provinces. I had singers and I had delights of every kind you can imagine. I was so great and increased more than any other one who was before me in Yerushalayim. And I had wisdom beyond anybody else. Whatever my eyes desired, I didn't hold back from them. I didn't withhold from myself any sense of joy, meaning any limitation to joy. I was able to rejoice and benefit from all of my toil. And I went and I took all of my deeds that I did. And then he gets into the frustrating part of it. But we'll get back to the frustrating part another time. But what's fascinating about this section here is not only is it written in first person, it's the most self-centered paragraph section in all of Tanakh. In this entire chapter, he uses the verb tense in first person 93 times. There is no other chapter in all of Tanakh in which first person verb tense is used 93 times. Kohelet starts with a world in which he sees, builds, enjoys, and is the front center of the universe. Everything revolves around him. What I have done, what I have created, what I have accomplished, what I have benefited from, what I understand, chochmati, ufaniti ani liruot chochma, I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness. He even starts with the phrase, I searched in my heart to cheer my flesh with wine, to enjoy, and to understand, and to understand sichlut, lechos b'sichlut, right? To remove folly and foolishness in order to embrace wisdom, until I could finally understand so that I could understand what was the good for the human being to do under the heavens, under the sun. And therefore, I did all of this, like a big giant experiment into the human condition. 93 times, it's all about him. That's the nehaneh. That's the hedonist. That's the philosopher, the chacham. That's the amal. That's the builder. And at the end of the book, when he comes back to the same metaphor with which the book began, and we start to talk about all the things that we don't know, it's not about me. It's about you. It's about not about what I know, yadati, baniti, I built and I created and I knew and I understood, etc. It's not about what I know. It's about what I don't know. Right? It's about the only thing that I know for certain is that God is there and that God runs this world. There's far more I don't know than what I do know. Bottom line. And this is where it all comes together to understand that Kohelet's journey from three people who will have a conversation, or three voices will have a conversation, and these three elements of these three voices certainly reflect, and we're going to talk about this next week, the world view and experience of Shlomo HaMelech, the great builder, the great hedonist for sure, with 1,000 wives. The great man of passion and wealth and accomplishment and philosophy, all of the things that he wanted and that he accomplished in this world. There's a fourth voice. And unfortunately in Kohelet, it doesn't come up as much as it should. In Shlomo HaMelech, in Kohelet, it's the fourth voice of the conversation. and that's the Yirei Elokim. And he takes each of these elements that represent these cycles and uses them to represent the notion that, yes, there's a cycle here, and I'm only looking at one part of it. And so to reach the point of emunah, I need to let go of the fact that I know everything and that I can see everything. If to use modern terminology, I don't think Shlomo HaMelech thought about it in these terms, but if I use modern terminology, it's the difference between science and religion. It's the difference between a world of science in which my goal is to measure everything in a laboratory. And that which I can measure, I can accept. That which I can't measure, I don't understand. It doesn't exist to an extent. Right? The notion of science versus the notion of faith and the recognition that that God runs this world in a way that can't be measured in a laboratory. There's a limit to the human knowledge potential. That's the cycle. That's how we break the cycle, by introducing the element of faith, the element of emunah, the element of knowledge that there is a limit to what the human being can know. Ki lo teda, what we don't know. Ki lo teda ma derech haruach. We don't know how the wind ends up in, the spirit ends up with the human being. Lo teda ma selikim. We can't know the deeds of God. In the morning, plant your seed, and in the erev also, ki encha yodea eze yichsha. How many times in these five verses does he say, you don't know? Until he comes to his conclusion, which is, the one thing you do know is that God runs the world. And so it's not a jump to go from here to the conclusion of the book, which is the last sentence of the book, which is Sof Davar Kol Nishmat Elokim Yiram Mitzvotav Shmor Kizeh Kol Adam. After all has been heard and said, fear God, keep His commandments, for that is the totality of the human being. Ki et kol maaseh Elokim yavi b'mishpat al kol ne'elam im tov v'imra, because God will bring everything into accountability and judgment, good and evil. That was His search. His search was for good and evil. His search was to understand tov and understand ra. In order to properly process it, he needs to bring into the conversation the fourth voice of the element of Yirei Elokim. That's our journey, to go from the metaphor with which the story begins, which is the metaphor of an endless cycle of nature that just doesn't seem to have a purpose, to recognizing that I may not see that purpose. But the foundation of belief, foundation of emunah, is to recognize that not everything do I see, not everything do I understand. If I'm driving on a road and I'm going uphill, I can't see the other side of the road on the other side of the hill that goes down. And yet I still drive up. Why? Because I have faith that the road continues on the other side. But I can't see it. Not everything in life can I see. That's the metaphor. Not everything in life can I see. How we go from Perek Aleph to Perek Yud Aleph, how we get from this self-centered world in which I'm trying to understand the world in human terms to a world of faith and emunah, that's the journey that Kohelet undertakes. And that will be our journey moving forward. That will be our task, to take us from point A, Chapter 1, to point Z, Chapter 11, or for the Canadians amongst us, Z. All right, Rabbi, we're going to stop here. I take us all the way to the end of the time. I apologize for not leaving a lot of time for questions. I'm happy to stay on for a few minutes if people do have questions. I see there's some stuff in the chat. I will try to save that and look at that, Bezrat Hashem. If there are questions, I'm happy to open the floor. Just unmute yourself and chime in.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Rabbi Shulman?
Yes.
Didn't succeed in getting a word in edgewise before your class. But Your first session, I had to get on archive. So I have something, I wasn't available in real time. So something I thought about when you said that they wanted, you know, lignozata hamigila, that they wanted to hide it away. But they wanted to hide it, but they didn't want to destroy it.
Well, it's a term that has a meaning. It's not an arbitrary term. They didn't physically go to the book and bury it or hide it. What it means is to remove it from the canon of Tanakh. Something goes into Geniza because it is not, our use of the term Geniza, because it is not of useful value anymore. So when they say they wanted a Gonez, whether it be Yechezkel or Kohelet, it basically means that they wanted to remove it from the canon of Tanakh, so it wouldn't have the religious status that the texts have. That's the meaning of the term. Because you can't hide a book.
Did they mean to erase it? Did they mean to erase it?
No, I don't think they meant to erase it, because there are other books that are not included in Tanakh that they clearly knew about, and they're not being gone. For example, there are books that are not included in the canon of Tanakh. And they're referred to as Svarim Chitzonim, right? The Apocrypha, or outside books. And the Chazal are very clear. On the one hand, they say you're not allowed to read them. And on the other hand, Chazal quote them all the time. The Book of Ben Sira, as an example, is quoted throughout the Talmud. So they were familiar with it, and yet they're saying you can't read it? That doesn't make sense. And the answer is that they're not saying you can't read it. What they're saying is you can't read it publicly. You can't give it the sanctity of Tanakh. Part of the process that Chazal, part of the mandate that the Chazal saw for themselves, and this goes back to the first mission of Perkei Avot, of the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, was to canonize Tanakh, was to close the story of what would be included and not included in Tanakh. And they did that in various ways. Books that they deliberated over and then decided and voted that they would be included. That's just that mission in Yadayim, or ban on public reading of books that are not part of Tanakh, but that people wanted to include. And Sira is an example. Later on, Sefer Maccabim is an example where there was an attempt to write it and to include it as a kind of a biblical book. And Chazal said no. For various reasons, the story of the era of prophecy had closed. But they had, but that was their language that they used. So they weren't hiding it in the sense of censorship.
Right.
But they were just making using a terminology that reflects the question of what was canonized, what was sanctified with the status of being included in Tanakh and what was excluded in Tanakh. There's a Mishnah in Perkei Avot that reads, that the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, one of the three things that they saw there, that they said was to be patient in judgment. There's a Braita on Perkei Avot called Avot Avinatan. And in that Braita, the concept of being meticulous in judgment is expanded, and the language there is Hevi Mitunim Badin. Be patient in judgment. Chezkel is in, Yechezkel is out. Kohelet is in. They wanted to exclude Kohelet. They decided to include Kohelet. They wanted to exclude. In other words, the Avot Rabbi Natan translates that whole notion of patience and judgment in the domain of the decision process over which books were included in Tanakh and which were not. Because that was part of the mandate, it was part of the mission of the of that period of time, of the early generations of the Second Temple, right? Megillat Esther is time period within the context before the close of prophecy. Chazal said, okay, Esther can be included, and therefore it's included in Tanakh. Whereas Chashmonaim was considered after the time period of the close of prophecy, and therefore they excluded it. There are other reasons as well. But that's part of that deliberation process, which is why I'm so adamant in my own sense of Tanakh that Kohelet is dated no later than that period of time, because that's when Chazal canonized Tanakh. All right.
Rabbi Shimon, from a tangential literary perspective, how do you understand the parallelism in Perek Bet Yud Gimel of Hechachamei Nav Barosho V'Aksil V'Choshech Holech? What is the literary parallelism there between a Nav Barosho and V'Choshech Holech?
Beyond what I said, which is that wisdom is the parable of light compared to is wisdom and darkness is ignorance.
Right. So where's the light in Einav Barosho?
You look with your eyes. Einav Barosho is Chacham Einav Barosho is a metaphor, is a euphemism or an idiom for walk with your eyes open, whereas the fool walks in darkness. I don't think it's much. I mean, maybe it's more than that, but that's how I think it's the same way it's used today, right? Walk with your eyes open is an idiom for a little bit of an open-mindedness. Yes.
I have a question about
Chris, what is your name? Because all your it just says iPad.
I'm sorry. No, that's not my name. It's Elaine. Elaine Jacobson.
Elaine.
Thank you, Rabbi Shulman. Since the Yirei Elokim comes at the end, it's not woven into the text. Is there any?
So I will stop you there with the assumption. I'll stop you there on the assumption. I just showed you one piece. As we go through the text, we'll identify two other places where the Yirei Elokim is speaking. Every one of the main personalities of Kohelet essentially speaks twice. The Yirei Elokim speaks three times. So I pulled out his concluding speech because he gets the last word.
Okay. Well, that answers my question. Okay. Thank you.
Right. No problem. Okay.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for joining us. And I hope that we will see you, Bezrat Hashem, next week.
Very good. Thank you very
Enjoy.
Much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Stay well.
Oh, it's great to see you. I see you waving there. It's nice to see you.